I am Mrs. Dial, president of the Chatham Historical Society. I'm very pleased to present Benjamin O. Eldridge, who will give you recollections from his lifetime in Chatham.
I was born in Chatham in 1878 in a house situated on Stage Harbor Road. One that my father moved from East Howard, built by his father. I have seen many changes, especially in that part of the town. In my first recollections, the stagecoach and the packet was the chief mode of transportation. The old stagecoach ran between Chatham and Howard. The train left Howard about 7 o'clock in the morning. The old stagecoach had to get underway by 4:30 or 5. Go about town picking up the passengers, and in bad weather to get to Howard on time. The packets, which ran from the coast as far north as the coast of Maine, as far south perhaps as the Capes of Virginia, north bringing in our lumber, and once in a while we had a very mild winter, and they had to bring in a load of ice. A great deal of our groceries and things, of course, came from Boston. The packets that went south, of course, would bring in our coal. They would bring in our corn. Perhaps you've often wondered why that 3 or 4 or 7 mills would be in this town. How the farmers found grain enough to keep the mills going, but it was a vessel load after vessel load of corn that was, came into Chatham, of course, by packets. Mostly, of course, salt was brought in. A man was moving where he'd take his family and his goods and everything and put them aboard of a packet, and he'd go to his destination. There was only one telephone when I was a boy, and I thought it was quite wonderful to see my father go up to Captain Zebe Nixon and talk in this instrument on the wall. There was no bathtubs of any description, no running water, no plumbing of any description. And of course, we know about moving pictures and televisions and such stuff as that. Of course, that's come in very lately. Roads was old, dusty roads in the summer and muddy in the winter. There's one thing about it that was kind of peculiar. When the old stagecoach ran up to Howard, they would clear the road on the right-hand side going up the hill and leave the left-hand side sandy for when the coach came down, that the horses could hold it back. So now, of course, Stage Harbor Road probably was the chief road in the town, most important road, because all of our goods came that way, and they were carted from Stage Wharf up through the town. And I think perhaps there were more stores in that vicinity, perhaps in any part of the town. In my remembrance, there was 3 or 4 grocery stores right on the Stage Harbor Road. And besides, there'd be 4 scales that we'd drive on a whole horse and cart right onto them. Things of that description. Now, of course, my grandfather brought the old marine railways. It was called the small shipways, across from Nantucket and around Civil War times. It was first put up over to the west of the coal storage. And there, he built a vessel, the T&C Hawes. He had a man by the name of Cannon. That was the chief builder, and he was getting 37.5 cents an hour for building a ship. And then, of course, my grandfather died or went out of the business. He run a store down at that time, too. But when there the railway was changed hands and went into the, where they took up shares, they called it the Chatham Howard Marine Railway, taking up in shares. I forget how many shares it was in that. But see, the vessels would come down from Dennis, They come from Howard, and they have come from Ferris Gloucester and up as far as New London, haul out on the railways. Of course, a good many of the wrecks happen off here. They got them off, they pull them onto the railways and repair them. The old railways, of course, went by horsepower. The old horse went round and round in the head house and pulled the vessel up. Of course, a heavy vessel, but they tripped the pawl and she'd run off herself. But a small, light vessel, they had to back her down just the same as they pull her up. And you'd be surprised to see the number of vessels that was in Stage Harbor. They were so thick that they even had to haul them up in the winter in the mill pond and in the oyster pond. On Harding's Beach, there were two stores and two wharves, fish companies. They had then, of course, they had fitting out stores. They had salt, they had grocers of some description. Then, of course, as we go down farther down towards Monomoy, we find the Brant Island, where the Branters or shooters came for twice a year to kill Brant. That was a club. And then we found Inwood Point, which was quite well inhabited by small shanties. Then we went down a little farther and we found these weir shanties. And then we found, between the weir shanties, we found a factory for making guano. And then, of course, we went on to Monomoy and we found the big stores. We found the fitting out shops or stores. Great stores down in wharves. That's where all of our fishermen fitted out during the Civil War, go to Grand Banks. Of course, the codfish was a principal food at that time. And I never knew, I've often tried to find out why it was called Powder Hole, but I don't know as I've ever found out. I perhaps could tell you some little experience there on going to the Grand Banks. This is what my father told me. He was on the Grand Banks off Newfoundland in the Civil War times. He had the schooner D.W. Nickerson. And Sunday morning, they had just wet the salt. That means they had got the trip. They'd used the salt all up and they were getting ready to come home. They're washing down, stowing the doors away, bending the mainsail. And the fog and wind, the fog lifted. There was no wind, the fog lifted. And the Confederate privateer Tallahassee was amongst them. And he came aboard the vessels and took off the crew and bored holes in them and sunk them. Father said that they prayed for wind and fog and to shut in foggy, and he got clear. And when he came into the point, into Powder Hole, they asked him if he'd seen anything of Stephen Howes. He had a vessel, the Mercy J. Howes, named for his wife. And Father said no, he was to leave the banks the same day that he did. But well, they says then they've got him, because says his vessel is faster than yours. But they'd captured Captain Howes, and they'd taken him and carried him down and sailed down on the coast of South America, and they were capturing ships at that time, and they captured an old brig, and they put all the prisoners aboard this brig and told them, if you will steer such and such a course, you've got just food and water enough to last you to get into that port. So the men from here started for the Grand Banks, and they ended up down in South America. And of course they lost all their dories and things, but I don't know whether it was paid for afterward. Now, of course, it seemed kind of strange to you young folks to look off back at Chatham in the winter time in the nor'wester, perhaps, and see 200 or 300 vessels anchored off there. You see, they'd get up as far as Cape Cod in the nor'wester, and they couldn't get by the Cape. They'd come back here and anchor. And the old folks used to say it looked like a cedar swamp. The mast was so thick in the daytime, it looked like a city in the night when it was all lit up. And the vessels were lit up as the riding lights, and so forth and so on. Well, I don't know. I didn't go on too much now. If I've run out of material, if you want to ask any questions.
The early days of the tourist business.
Well, there was the most beautiful hotel that was ever built on Cape Cod was built up in Chatham Port, now where the Eastern Hole Country Club is. And they had a railroad station in West Chatham, I think was called the Hotel Chatham Station at that time. All the lumber came there at West Chatham and was carted across. I can remember as a boy, my father started out early in the morning to cart lumber there, and I would walk up to West Chatham Depot and then perhaps go across with him and cart the lumber. But unfortunately, it was a little bit too early. It was none but the horse and buggy days. There was no automobiles, and it only run for 3-4 years and was finally tore down. There's one other thing that I would like to say about the ships. I was reading an account where they kept count of the number of vessels that went by Chatham Light in 1 year, and I presume that was in daylight. And it was 14,847 vessels that passed Chatham Lights. That is, it'd be in the daytime. Some of the lights give around 22,000 ships. That's in 1876, as I read this account. They had, around 1846, I was reading an account where they had a debating society in town, and one of the questions was whether it resolved that the shipwrecks in Chatham was of no real value to the town. Of course, I don't see how they could stop it by debating on it, but that was the debate. But, of course, some of them said, the men, they got a lot of business, made a lot of business employment for men to get the ships off and to strip them. And then, of course, they said it made a woodpile for them. And then they could get the metal out of them, and so forth and so on. That was the question. Now, how much more time have I got?
Well, go ahead, Mr. Albert. You have one more incident you wanted to mention.
Yeah. My really first experience in the life-saving service was at the old Monomoy station. I joined the station then as a substitute Thanksgiving Eve. And it was I went out on the beach at 12 o'clock at night. Know these snowstorms, and had hard work to find the halfway house, which is up west of Branch Enders. Next morning, the lookout came down at daylight from the tower and reported a small schooner anchored down off the Stunhorse with the flag union down and half mast. We immediately lanced our boat on the inside and went down to her, and it was a little schooner Fair Wind. From Ellsworth, Maine, bound up the Hudson with a load of staves. The night before, they was up off the handkerchief, and they tried to tack ship. She wouldn't tack, and they had to wire ship. They hooked on the boom tackle, hauled the main boom out, and it parted. The cabin was to the wheel, and he got caught in the main sheet and it around his ankle, and it took him down between the bit head and the load of staves. He sprained his ankle, dislocated his shoulder and broke his ribs. We went aboard of her and tried to get we got her anchor and we tried to get her into Hyannis. That was early in the morning. At noon, the cook said dinner. He had beside the cook and the captain. And the cook gave the crew 2 pieces of salt pork for Thanksgiving dinner, fried up crisp. We had no dinner at all. We went in, finally we got up, pretty well up off Hyannis, just moderate. We took the boat, left one man aboard, and we took the boat and rowed into Hyannis Harbor and went ashore to get the doctor. We got an old horse, team, and a man by the name of Clocker, I think, kept a lighthouse down there. Went up, got Dr. Hawes and brought him down. By that time, the schooner got into Hyannis. We took the doctor off aboard, and he tried to etherize the cabin. He was an old man, Cabin Keith. He had been a deep water man. He'd had a fortune of $50,000, and he'd stayed ashore and lost it, and he had to take a small vessel again. And he'd been married again, had a family of children. His oldest son was lost in the Johnson Bowen down here, loaded with ice. She rolled bottom up off Pollock Rip. So, anyhow, we couldn't authorize him. Had to go take the doctor ashore again. He had to go up to Highness and get chloroform. And chloroform him. So, I remember, I remember now he's breathing, sleeping there. But he knew what's going on, because we was cutting clothes off him. He said there's no need, he says, cutting his clothes off. He seemed to know everything. But anyhow, we cut his clothes off and bound him up. And I remember the doctor got down on the floor alongside him, took his shoe off and put his foot up under his shoulder and Paul set his shoulder back. I remember that. So that's my first experience in doctoring. So that factor would, that one. And I guess perhaps I would like to tell perhaps a little story about, I was reading about a Nantucket man. Perhaps I feel good he'll say if he does. This Nantucket man said that he had drank 73 barrels of liquor in 34 years and still was unhappy. So I think I'm unhappy about talking on this thing. I don't know how
it does. A group of us.
At this point, Mr. Aldridge, possibly the... those of us who probably haven't read too closely of the old life-saving stations and the halfway house that you mentioned, if you could describe them in a little more in detail as to how many men were stationed there at the time and how many wrecks that you participated in and so forth.
Don't
you
worry.
Don't
you
run that back
over
here?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, see, of course... the town of Chatham had perhaps more stations than any town on the Cape. We had four. We had, you see, the old harbor station was the third that was built. The Monomoy Point station, after the loss of the crew down there, that was the next one was put on the point. Now here, this the old harbor station was built in 1898, and it was manned out the May 1st. I was one of the first members of went on there. It was manned out May 1st, 1898. It was a beautiful Sunday morning, one of the beautiful days you ever saw, and it was the same day that Dewey took the Battle of Manila Bay. See, that station was built on account of the schooner Kelvin B. Orcutt being lost with all hands. That was the only ship that ever came onto the Chatham shores, and the men knew it was there and never made any effort to reach her. You see, it was such a tight blizzard. I know old man Rufus Nixon, been boat fishing all of his life, and he said he lost his way going to the shore that night, and he didn't think there was any use trying to go across the beach. Of course, they had pilot boats, you know, that they call pilot boats, they rowed.
Yes,
yeah.
But there were other wrecks before that.
Oh, yes, well, oh, yes, there was wrecks all up and down through there. Of course, we had every, of course, in the bad weather, snowstorms or thick weather or very dark, of course, we had to have marks on the beach where we knew. We had the old Stover's Bow, we called it. And then we had the Richard K. Fox, a part of her timbers. You see, we knew just where we was. Night, when we came down, it was dark or thick fog. I've come down the beach with a southeast rainstorm, and I've heard it, and I couldn't breathe hardly, but I had to turn back to almost in a while. And I've heard say you couldn't see your hand before you. Well, we wore those white Nova Scotia mittens, and I've held them up like that and couldn't see them. So, you see, we had to know pretty much where we were. And
what other equipment did you have to carry and to wear?
Well, only when we came south, of course, we didn't meet anyone. We had a time clock. We had to go down there. We had a key on our time clock. It unlocked a safe. Then we took the key out of the safe and punched a clock. Well, you see, of course, the captain, the first day along, the captain had to get up 12 o'clock every night and change that dial. He had made a pressure, a little hole in the dial just what time we, so they knew that we covered our beat, see. And the halfway houses, of course, are fixed up with a little, had a little, what we call a little ramcat stove in it. And then it had a telephone, and that's about all. As I know, when we took off the LCM Smith, I think we had about 13 or 15 men in that 6x8 room there, in that little building, wringing out the clothes and things. Of course, it's pretty crowded.
Oh,
yes, we patrolled the beach. We had 4 hours each way. Two men went out. One went south, one went north.
Well, Well, now, could you tell us just exactly what would happen if you received a call or you saw someone in distress? Just what would you do? What would the describe how you'd go about it, the boat and equipment and so forth?
Well, the only thing, of course, we called what we call a Coston signal. We had some kind of a frame or something that we had made of wood, and then there was this thing on the bottom we punched, and we put in a red flare. And by punching that, we'd set that red flare off. So that was to tell the people on the wreck that we had seen them, and assistance would be given as soon as possible. Well, then, of course, if we were at the halfway house, why, we'd telephone to the station. But if we was near the station, we'd run back and get all hands out. I know one night that was, of course, we were on there during the Spanish-American War. Of course, the old lifesavers is a forgotten man. It's the only man that the government has forgotten. They'd never give him a pension or anything.
The government used to give him a medal, though, once in a while.
Well, once in a while, of course, I've got a medal, but it was given to me by the fellow that I saved, not by the government, but the government used to give him a medal. But the old lifesavers was never any pension or anything. It was always their forgotten men.
Mr. Bloomer. Did he receive recognition at all?
Mr. Bloomer.
Bloomer?
George Bloomer? Yeah, but he got it. He got it before he was in the life-saving service. He took it. I think Herbert Burse, it was Zeni Hawes. There was quite a few of them got medals at that time for taking the schooner. I know one time as I went up and down the, as I was telling you, during the Spanish-American War, we were called back. We were. When I went on, and in 1898, we had 10 months on and 2 months off. We signed up for a year. But when the Spanish-American War came on, why, we was called back into signal service. And I went up and down that beach five times between 8 o'clock and 4 the next morning. I was going up, we used to meet, that's before we had the halfway house. That's when the station was first manned out. We used to go up and meet the Orleans man up there, and we'd set in the hollow and build a fire and watch the sand fleas hop into it, you know. That was so this time I was going up, and I got most up to where we, halfway place, and I saw this light, and since I guess it was Captain Abbott Walker, so I guess Abbott's got down ahead of me. So I see it was a red light, and then went out. I rushed up there, and it was a schooner Zenobia, loaded a box herring. She was right on the beach. So I'd gone up to a thick fog. Remember that night, it was warm weather. I think it was the 27th of July. So I started for the station, and he started for the North Station. Just when I went into the old harbor, the captain of the Orleans Station was talking with Captain Doan. Well, that made two times. I went up and went back. That was 5 miles. And then Captain Doan, we got out, and we all hands started up. I think the Orleans Station was going to bring our boat down. So we run up there again. Well, that made three times. Well, then Captain Doan said along about 3 o'clock in the morning, or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he says, "Guess you better go down to the station." That was a Saturday night. Says, "You cook day next day." He says, "Guess you better go down to the station." So I started, and I commenced to pick up clothes. The boys walking, running up there, you know, they'd throw clothes off. So I had a load of clothes, got most down to the station, looked offshore, and there was the little schooner Seabird. She was ashore. So I downed all my clothes that I had then and let her go back again. So that made five times. Then we took the boat and come down. We got the Seabird off, but the Zenobia laid there with box herring. They unloaded all that, and finally, I think after 3-4 weeks, some they got her off and took into Provincetown, carted the box herring up to Orleans and shipped them on. So then when we went up there, well, we had plenty of herring to chew on, don't you know.
Could you tell us how many shipwrecks that you can recall, that you participated in?
I don't know.
Quite a few hundred, would you say?
No. Well, no. Of course, the worst trouble that we had, one of the greatest troubles we had was, as I told you before, was when this fleet of vessels was anchored off here in a heavy nor'wester. Well, then there was always somebody be in trouble. We'd always have to go off to them. Some of the vessels had departed and gone to sea, and the towboats had taken the crew off, and we'd go off and get the crew. Or there'd be one of them that'd be full of water and all listed over, had a list, you know, the port or starboard. And I always remember, I think it was around January the 1st, I think it was a day or two after that, we went off the no new towboat to Lackawanna. She was a two-stacker. And she was in trouble off here, and we went off to her. And as we went off, the Chatham crew was off to the schooner Emma D. Endicott. And she had loaded the coal, and she had listed over. Chicago shifted, and I always remember Charlie Howells. You remember, Medrick. He was there. He was there aft. He was the only fellow out one side, and I hollered, Charlie, we went by the stern of her. I hollered, Happy New Year, Charlie. I said, Happy New Year, be there. So, I know, but I always remember there was a little, there was a boy aboard of her, and then he was around, had his head all tied up with a rag, you know. He'd been hit, he got hit in the head with a tail block on the stay-so. And they were waiting around water. Finally, they got underway. I think towboat took her. That's the way we had a lot of trouble that way, don't you know?
Next speaker will be Edwin Aldrich, chairman of the Board of Selectmen, who will give us some information regarding Monomoy of the old days and our feeling for it today.